Hello everyone, and welcome to the Four Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I'm your host, King Good Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Rob Dan.
I'm Rob Dan, am I?
Yep, and Mick Thra.
I knew you were going to do that.
Mick Thra worked a lot better as kind of a combination of words in my head, but is actually quite unpleasant to say.
I know. I thought you were going to go with Rob Thra. I was like, that sounds horrible.
Oh, no.
Anyway, yes, Godzilla King of the Monsters is out in the cinemas right now, and I'm a wee bit excited about it. I don't know if I've mentioned it before on the show, by which I mean I have mentioned it often and at length. Freaking love a bit of Godzilla.
Who doesn't?
Mick, apparently.
Yeah, big monster movie. Meh.
But it's the big monster movie.
Yeah, but unfortunately there's been so many poor big monster Godzilla movies that I'm immune to them now.
Well, when you say poor, are you talking about Hollywood versions?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. As long as you don't diss the original Godzilla, I'm okay.
No, I mean, I used to love them.
Yeah, no one's going to invent the first ever Godzilla movie all the way back in 1998.
Don't you dare. Apparently he is no longer officially called Godzilla. He is just referred to as Zilla.
What?
Yeah, that Godzilla from 1998 is only referred to as Zilla now. There was a movie called Godzilla Final Wars where it was basically Godzilla in this ongoing grudge match against every single one of his enemies. And Zilla turned up and Godzilla basically just slammed him down with like one hit.
Hold on, how did Zilla end up being Godzilla's enemy?
Because, well, it's Godzilla, and obviously he hates that version that Hollywood did.
Okay.
King of the Monsters is good, though. I rather enjoyed it a lot.
It gave you what you wanted, which was big monsters punching each other.
Yeah, I think it was big monsters punching each other. Yeah.
So is this Godzilla King of the Monsters a follow-up to the 2014 Godzilla Hears Some Brief Glimpses of Some Monster?
Yeah, but the thing is, they've kind of done what Michael Bay did with Transformers, where the first Transformers movie, they didn't really have much of a budget to get Optimus Prime and the rest of Transformers on the screen for a lot of the movie. But now the technology has moved on by like 4 or 5 years, and right, money is much more, you know, much more. Everyone knows Godzilla movies are profitable now, so they threw more money at it, and so you basically had Charles Dance and the rest of them being more like bit part characters, holding together this shoestring of a story that was designed just to piece together events from one monster fight to the other.
It was also, John, my favourite bit in the movie was
what?
So, Vera Farmiga's character, she's the one who's going around, kind of unleashing all the monsters, with, you know, helping out Charles Dance.
Yeah,
and her character, she had a son named Andrew who died in Godzilla's 2014 attack.
Yep.
And there's this great line where Millie Bobby Brown, who plays the daughter, just yells at you, "Is this what Andrew would have wanted?" I'm sat there in the cinema going, "Yes! Yes, it is! Release them all! Release them all!"
I will be honest, when I went to see it and that line came up, I was just sitting there going, "Yep." My first thought was of you at that point, going, "Yep."
Yeah, it's freaking great because you've got Godzilla, you've got Rodan, you've got Mothra, and you've got King Ghidorah, and they just proper slam down.
It is. It's basically, see, I reckon Godzilla eventually will go the way that Transformers has gone, where Michael Bay has finally realized he could just do 2 hours of giant robots fighting giant robots repeatedly with no storyline whatsoever and no rhyme or reason, and he would make all of the money.
Oh man, I can't wait for the film where it turns out that Godzilla's like the one true king of England.
Exactly. See, that's the thing. Transformers makes no sense whatsoever now. You don't need a story, you just need giant robots hitting each other, and Godzilla's going to go down that route as well.
Despite hating that Transformers franchise, yeah, I want that for my Godzilla movies.
See?
maybe like occasionally cutting back to some kind of human characters going, should we do anything about this?
Maybe. Should we call the army or the air force or someone like that?
Gotta love the optimism of the army in Godzilla movies, who always somehow think they're going to be in any way helpful.
It's a long tradition, though, that goes right back to 1933's King Kong movie and the the biplanes, the flimsy biplanes going up against King Kong.
Yeah.
To be fair, though, they won. How does a big monkey that gets shot to death by wooden planes stand a chance against the king of the monsters?
See, I never understood that, because the guns on those biplanes weren't very good, and it's King Kong, so given his size, his skin would have been like a centimetre thick and like toughened leather, so he would have been able to resist some of the bullets at least. The physics of it just don't fit.
Maybe one of the pilots in one of the biplanes got a lucky shot in and got him in the exhaust port.
And they had to cut that bit out of the movie where King Kong just suddenly goes, ooh!
Cheeky!
Doing his best Frankie Howard impression.
Matron!
No, that was Kenneth Williams, wasn't it?
I know.
They're all the same, aren't they? Just old people.
See, now I want Frankie Howard as King Kong.
Versus Sid James as Godzilla.
So for me, the 2014 Godzilla movie was like a branded version of Cloverfield.
Yeah, I remember when we were talking about this ages ago. I think it was the episode called Bryan Cranston's Godzilla Onesie, where we were talking...
Yeah, that's right, because we came to the conclusion that that film would have been 100 times better if Bryan Cranston had been playing Godzilla.
Yeah, and to practice for the role... He'd basically bought himself a Godzilla onesie and was wandering around his house going, rawr, at people.
You see, that sounds like the plot of Big Man Japan.
So, yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So, the thing is, though, we are not a movie podcast.
No, that's true.
We are a comics podcast, and luckily Godzilla has a pretty long and storied history in comics.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, so his comic book appearances actually date back all the way to the 50s, like literally 1954, the same year the original movie came out in cinemas. There was a manga adaptation, and I believe Godzilla's been in quite a few mangas, hasn't he, Rob?
Godzilla has been in quite a few manga. Basically, every single film that they did in Japan got a manga version, and a lot of them also got sequel manga versions.
So was this basically the launch of the Godzilla cinematic universe?
Well, yeah, effectively. Godzilla as a multimedia franchise is massive. People don't realise just how huge Godzilla is, and I'm not just talking in terms of size, but in terms of range of products. I mean, you're talking everything from movies to comic books to plushies to toys to video games to... water pistols, toy cars, cartoons, anime, you name it. If I just did a quick search for Godzilla manga, there's the current one, which, you know, the anime movie that's on Netflix, the trilogy?
Yeah, I do.
There is a
manga. You said that in a way that led you to not like it very much.
It's probably because they're quite bad.
Okay.
There is a manga version of those. There's a manga version of Godzilla, just called Godzilla. There's Godzilla vs. Space Godzilla, Godzilla vs. Boylante, Godzilla vs. Mecha Godzilla, Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah, just to name a few.
Oh. Does it have whichever one he fights Baragon in?
I think so, yeah. I think that cool. one's one as well.
Because I watched another Godzilla movie, which was Godzilla, Mothra, and King Ghidorah All Out Attack.
Yeah.
Which is like just a random Japanese one. And that was my introduction to Baragon, and Baragon's the best. Because it's like an adorable puppy rhino.
Yep. There's also another Godzilla manga from 1992-93, I think it was, called King of the Monsters. It wasn't Godzilla Final Wars, but it was Godzilla Final Wars in manga form before Godzilla Final Wars. It was just basically Godzilla in a series of fights against other kaiju, all of whom were revived by a mad scientist.
Speaking of Baragon, I was looking at this, and apparently the first fight Godzilla fights against Sea Baragon.
Yep.
Which is, and I quote, a hybrid between Baragon, a walrus, and a narwhal.
It has a horn.
It does have a horn. Until Godzilla just snaps it off.
See, you covered one actually on this show a while ago, Andrew. Godzilla in Hell. It wasn't a manga, but it was a very manga-esque comic book.
Shh, Rob, no.
Oh?
We're getting to that.
Oh, okay.
Stop using your vast psychic gifts to peer into the future.
All right.
It's not conducive to a timeline.
All right. Are you going through all the monsters that you fought in this manga first?
No, but is that the show people want? Just me sitting here naming as many Godzilla monsters as I possibly can?
And your time starts now.
Godzilla, Anguirus, Baragon, King Ghidorah, Mothra, Rodan, Minilla, Godzuki, Godzilla Jr., Megalon.
Godzuki, I thought that was Godzilla's cute nephew from the cartoon series of the 1970s.
He's still a monster.
Exactly. You never specified.
Why would he fight his own nephew?
No, we never said anything about fighting. We just said naming all the monsters.
Oh, right. Okay.
Biollante, the big shrimp, a spider.
Mechagodzilla 1, 2, and 3.
And of course, mankind's own hubris. The greatest monster of all.
Oh, you forgot about one.
I mean, there's been like 33 Godzilla movies, Rob. I forgot quite a few.
No, you forgot Mecha Kong, or whatever it was.
Mecha Kong.
Hold on, I thought that was Dan Dare's bad guy.
That's, wow. Possibly of all the jokes for all the niche audiences we've made on this show.
Is that the nichest of the niche?
Yeah. I think on the Venn diagram of people who A, remember the Mechon, and B, remember Mecha Kong. That's a
very small number of people. See, I remember the Mechon and I remember Mecha Kong, but I'm a rarity.
Can I just say to the people who inhabit that Venn diagram that both of you are welcome?
I will say that version of Dan Dare was so much better.
So anyway, when we say Godzilla in comics, I think probably the thing that jumps to a lot of people's minds first is Godzilla's debut in Western comics, which was back in the 70s, 77 to 79 to be precise, when Marvel Comics bought the rights and did a 24-issue run of Godzilla comics written by Doug Moench and drawn by Herb Trimp. And the really like weird thing for me about these comics is they're just set in the Marvel Universe. Like, there was a period of time when Godzilla was just fighting the Avengers.
Yeah, I remember. He flicked his claw and Thor was sent flying. It was when he was the king of the monsters in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, it's weird, because obviously eventually Marvel Comics lost the rights to Godzilla. But there's still, like, a bunch of stuff from those comics that just exists in the Marvel Universe. Like a Red Ronin, which is a giant samurai robot. And, there was a Dr. Dude.
Wasn't Fing Fang Foom kind of a Godzilla thing? Or was that a separate thing?
No, I think Fing Fang Foom was a separate thing, because I think he was an Iron Man first.
Ah, okay.
The thing is, though, Marvel didn't really take rights very seriously when it came to Godzilla, though, did they?
No, there was kind of a period where it was just, oh no, we've lost the rights to Godzilla. Look, the evil scientist Dr. Demonicus has mutated our Godzilla so he looks completely different now. And then they just went on for a while like that. Just Iron Man fighting Marvel's legally distinct but similar to Godzilla monster.
Which they eventually renamed Warning.
And then I think they killed off.
Yeah, because people wanted to read about Godzilla, but no one wanted to read about Warning.
So that was kind of the end of Godzilla at Marvel Comics. Then the rights were later bought by Dark Horse. And so yeah, they kind of did a lot of Godzilla stuff. It's like over a decade, from about 1987 to 1998. And this was kind of the period, I think it was this. And weirdly enough, the cartoon spin-off of the 1998 Godzilla movie are what, like, really got me into the franchise.
Really?
Yeah, don't knock that that cartoon series was, like, surprisingly really good.
Was that the one where you had the guy with the headset or the earpiece who kept calling Godzilla bro?
Yes. I mean, don't get... It was super 90s.
It doesn't sound anywhere near as good as the... I think it was either a Hanna-Barbera or Filmation.
I think it was Hanna-Barbera in conjunction with one of the Japanese studios for the rights. And just the theme tune up from the depths. Was it 30 or 40 stories? I can't remember. Breathing fire, his head in the sky.
I mean, it's no...
No, but it went, Godzilla, Godzilla. But then it went, and Godzuki.
Oh, I like that. I like that really embarrassed admission that Godzuki is also in the show.
There were 26 episodes.
Yes.
I mean, were there 26 episodes, or were there 3 episodes shown an awful lot of times with very slightly different plots?
I think there were 4 episodes that were then cut and pasted together in a variety of ways.
And just the same one shot of Godzilla firing his atomic breath.
Yeah. Oh, you have seen it then?
I feel like I've seen enough clips online to have basically seen the entire thing. By which I mean I've seen a couple of minutes. But yeah, the 90s cartoon series, actually pretty fun. It was basically... Because you know how at the end of beloved 90s classic Godzilla, Matthew Broderick basically finds a bunch of eggs with baby Godzillas in them? So the idea is, and this was also eventually going to be the sequel to that film, one of the eggs hatches, but then the baby Godzilla imprints on Matthew Broderick. And so then they just kind of team up and start fighting other monsters, including, and this might be my favourite version of Mechagodzilla, is like, it's the Godzilla from the film, but like brought back as a weird like cyborg zombie. It was a rad show. And the 90s were some rad Godzilla comics, because I read them. Basically, I read them at a time when I was definitely far too young to have read them. But it's that classic old cliche of the library that just takes all the comics and goes, well, these are all for kids, so we'll put them in the kids section.
Yeah.
And so... Bright-eyed young Andrew gets to read lots of content that he definitely shouldn't have read at a young, impressionable age.
This explains an awful lot.
Yes.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. That therapy bill that you keep getting, for example.
It is my poor, exasperated doctor, good psychologist. He keeps telling me that he's not there for me to just summarise all the Godzilla films, including sound effects, but I don't listen. Incidentally, I saw a behind-the-scenes video for that other Godzilla film I watched, and turns out another reason I love Baragon is that the stunt actress who plays him, she basically roared, like she did a little roar when she was playing it, and then they just dubbed over that later. So you just get to see like a big monster running around, and then a tiny Japanese voice going, "Bah!" But yeah, it was cool, because the Godzilla comic I really remember was one called Godzilla vs. Hero Zero, which was, I think, a crossover with one of Dark Horse's other property. And Hero Zero is basically Iron Man crossed with Ultraman. So it looks like Iron Man, but he can grow to kind of Godzilla size. And I just always remember like this story where he basically fights Godzilla and loses. Like, he gets his ass kicked. Godzilla stomps off. Then he like looks around to see his friend has been crushed to death in the rubble of the attack. And like, as a kid, that was one of those like, whoa, that superhero got his butt kicked. Godzilla's rad. But of course, it is only the second best Dark Horse Godzilla comic. The best, of course, being from 1993, written by what I think is a pseudonym, Mike Baron, with art by Jeff Butler and Keith Aiken.
Mm.
Godzilla vs. Barkley. the official comic adaptation of the 90s like Nike commercial. Charles Barkley just defeats Godzilla at basketball. Which I think is, to this date, the most successful any human being has been against Godzilla. You know, it's just like that classic line from the end of King Kong. "'Twas sick dunks that killed the beast." I'm starting to realise I'm the only one who's read any 90s Godzilla comics, aren't I?
No, yeah. You're not. I'm just contemplating...
I was comic agnostic in the 90s.
That's my point. I'm contemplating 90s Godzilla comics. See?
Oh, yeah. Look, I realise they probably have not aged well.
No, they have not.
Like, this is just speaking from the experience of a young, impressionable child. For whom just the very concept of a superhero losing a fight was kind of revolutionary.
Yeah. But this is the biggest problem. The 90s were just weird for comics in general. This was the era when you had Superman versus Muhammad Ali. And, as you said, Godzilla versus Charles Barkley.
Yep.
Slam dunking off the Empire State Building.
Yes. I mean, I don't know what you're trying to insinuate, Bob. That this is in some way not the highest of high arts.
Godzilla wearing a headband.
And big Godzilla-sized trainers.
I know.
Just the final line of that comic is just Godzilla got busy.
See, if we took that to its logical progression, right, from basketball, say Godzilla had the typical kind of basketball cliche upbringing that all the 90s movies wanted us to believe. So he's a kid off the main streets of like Brooklyn or something like that. And then he was good at basketball, but then he got into gangs and then he's into bling. So you'd have Gangster Godzilla. And then, you know, maybe he went to prison, but then he got good at rap while he was in Godzilla. So you'd have like Rap Godzilla later on.
That reminds me, another great thing about King of the Monsters is that the end credits music is a cover of Blue Oyster Cult's Go, Go, Godzilla.
Yes, it is. I forgot about that.
Has there been a Godzilla rap album? I feel like there must have been.
I don't know, but I think we should Google this. I want to know now.
Like, if the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles can have one.
Yeah, but what you've got to remember is that sometimes a rap soundtrack for a movie doesn't work well. Remember Venom? I mean... What do you want?
Every day I remember.
Godzilla. Hey, he's going to thrill you. I mean, you know.
That's...
I mean, yes, that's exactly what I want, Mick.
That's Emmy Award, that's Grammy Award winning stuff, that.
There is a...
I want Will Smith to do a Godzilla rap and perform it at the end of the next movie.
There is a Godzilla rap called King of the Monsters by Torn Z. Whoever that is.
Excellent.
Well, that's you happy now, then.
It is. That's all I want.
I don't know who Tonsy is.
I mean, I used to think that what I wanted from life is, like, for any media to capture the true horror and awe-inspiring shock of seeing a gigantic lizard monster. But no, I just want some sick raps. Anyway, should we talk about actual good Godzilla comics now?
Yeah.
Because since 2010, and I believe still currently, the Godzilla rights have been owned by IDW, and they've done some tremendous stuff. Like, Rob, you mentioned Godzilla in Hell.
Yes.
Which, yeah, was just a fantastic five-issue. Basically, the idea is that after one of the numerous times he's been killed, Godzilla winds up in Hell. And it's just him making his way through, like, this weird, surreal, horrifying landscape. And then it ends on, like, a weirdly sort of beautiful note, where, like, Godzilla allows himself to be consumed by demons and then is reborn. But yeah, there's that one. And the other one that I'm a huge fan of, and might just in general be my favourite Godzilla thing, is James Stucco's Godzilla the Half-Century War, where it's another mini-series following basically a Japanese army. I think he's a private in the army. He's basically there in 1954 when Godzilla first attacks, and then kind of spends the rest of his life sort of chasing after and sort of confronting Godzilla just through the next, like, 50 years. And it's cool because, like, it really captures the idea that, like, Godzilla is just a force of nature, and that, you know, any attempts to sort of fight him or really even be noticed by him are ultimately kind of futile.
Yep. I like that whole idea. Basically adds kind of an implacability to Godzilla, you know? He's like Death and Taxes and the Terminator.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Godzilla hates humanity in the same way that we hate, like, an ant infestation.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's annoying and inconvenient and best do something about it. Or it's just in the way to something more important.
Yes.
That's, like, that's what I like about Godzilla. The kind of, it's almost that kind of Lovecraftian sense of there being something that's just, like, so huge, we don't even really register to it. And also, it's got plates on its back, and they light up and go womp, 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 and then it fires a big old fire blast.
Yep.
So it's not a fire blast, it's atomic breath.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's most of the thoughts I have on Godzilla.
Which is not most of the thoughts you have on Godzilla, that's just the ones referring to comic books. Let's be fair.
Okay, yeah, that is like an appropriate cross-section of the views I have on Godzilla for the purposes of this, an hour-long podcast.
I don't think Andrew's thoughts and feelings about Godzilla can be measured in words.
No, but if you are interested in those views, a 42-disc Blu-ray collection is available. It's audio only as well. For the relatively small price of £250,000,
yes,
we had to cover the cost of recording that much thought.
Yes, for that, you get 4 months' worth of Andrew just talking about Godzilla and how much he loves Godzilla.
I mean, it's about, I'd buy it.
And we've even added, if that's not enough for you, we've even added on the menu for the Blu-rays the option to loop it.
I mean, let's not forget Andrew's seminal conspiracy theory about how Godzilla gave H.P. Lovecraft the idea for Cthulhu, even though Godzilla came well after.
Think you'll find there's another Dark Horse comic that establishes that Godzilla can travel through time. Or possibly got sent back in time by aliens, I think. Actually, maybe the Dark Horse comics are bad. Yeah, full disclosure, I did kind of skim through some of them before we started recording. And just kind of thought, oh no, child me was wrong.
See, this is one of the reasons why I was silently remembering the 90s Godzilla comics.
The main characters of the Godzilla comics are part of an elite special unit called G-Force.
Yep.
But G-Force is a different thing.
I know it's a different thing. But apparently,
I remember G-Force fondly.
Yeah, Battle of the Planets. With Ken yeah. the Eagle and Jun the Swan and characters like that.
Yeah. Transmute.
It's fine. Godzilla ate them all before the start of the series, maybe.
Oh, they've got some indigestion, especially if they were in fiery phoenix mode.
Maybe that's why he's got the fiery breath.
Oh, it could be. Oh, yeah.
There we go. That's the real secret origin of Godzilla.
He swallowed the fiery phoenix of G-Force.
And does that mean Godzilla can transmute?
Well, maybe not now. Maybe that's the ultimate transmutation.
No, he can transmute. He transmutes cities into rubble, people into ashes, other monsters into decorative headpieces.
But can't transmute himself from an orphan into a protector of the galaxy.
See, now I've got, like, Magical Girl Godzilla.
I mean, if you think about it, Godzilla is an orphan. And I guess him, like, mutating from an ordinary sea creature into a giant monster is kind of like a transformation. And King Ghidorah is an evil space dragon that wants to destroy the universe. Godzilla's basically a magical girl.
Don't. Because I've got, like, Sailor Moon crossed with Godzilla now.
Oh, but don't worry, folks. Volume 2 of the DVD collection coming soon.
Oh, I hate you so much, Andrew. Putting that thought in my head. And you, Mick. Especially you, Mick. You're the culprit. You're the instigator. You led Andrew down this dark, dark path.
He needs little leading.
It's true. Obviously, all I really need is telling that said path exists.
Yeah.
And then I'll have...
He happily goes off and finds it himself.
Beverly skips down, arms are flailing.
Recording the GPS information into Google.
On that note, I think we need a break.
We'll be back in 3 weeks' time.
Hi, this is Krillin. And this is Usopp. And you're listening to The Geek Show.
Cartoons, they're not just for kids anymore, except the ones that are actually for kids, they're for kids. If you liked that, then tune in to Keyframe for more scintillating insights about the world of animation. Part of the Geek Show's podcast network, we'll tell you whether it's as good as Ghibli or just plain giblets.
Hello, and welcome back to part two of this week's four panel, where we'll be doing my favourite bit, stuff what we have read with our eyes. And I believe, Andrew, you're kicking us off.
Am I?
I thought I was.
I'm old. I have very short-term memory.
Again?
Shall I do that?
30 seconds ago, Mick. 30 seconds.
No, just leave it. Let's just roll with it.
No, fine. I'm going first, apparently.
Okay.
Right, what have I been reading? I have been reading The Legend of Korra, Ruins of the Empire, Part 1. So this is the next Legend of Korra, kind of, well, in the sort of comic book sequels that they've been doing. This one is written by Michael Dante DiMartino, with art by Michelle Wong, and covers by Vivian Ng, and letters by Rachel Deering. So this is, again, set after the final season of Legend of Korra. This time instead focuses on the Earth Empire, who were the villains of that season, and their leader Kuvira, she's been kind of captured and imprisoned. But instead of disbanding, the Earth Empire is now controlled by Commander Guan, a kind of a elite soldier in that empire, who refuses to follow his leader's orders anymore and is going to strike out on his own. It's a very Star Wars expanded universe plot. Like, it's almost exactly sort of the Thrawn trilogy, isn't it?
Yeah, it sounds a lot like it.
Which I'm not necessarily complaining about. I think it's a cool plot and is a very logical way kind of for this story to continue.
Well, I'll be honest, I always did like the Heir to the Empire trilogy, the Timothy Zahn one, where they introduced the character of Admiral Thrawn.
Yeah, and I think it makes a lot of sense to say, like, okay, you've got this entire army of, like, fanatical zealots.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily just all going to go, oh, our boss has been captured, guess we better all pack it in.
No, they're not. The Empire doesn't collapse just because the Emperor's dead. If that was the case, every time a Roman Emperor died, they'd have to rebuild Rome from scratch.
Yeah, exactly. But also what I like is it's not necessarily just the same, oh, there's a new Earth Empire, we've got to go fight them. Because being a strategist, instead of going out on the offensive, he just strolls up to the Earth Kingdom on the day when basically they are transitioning away from monarchy into democracy, and just says, I'd like to put my name down to be the next prime minister. So it's getting all political intriguey.
Sounds good.
It is. I enjoyed this one a lot. I think I've got a little bit of trepidation. Because I know the last Korra thing I did, that started off strong, but then kind of ended with a bit of a whimper rather than a bang.
From what you're saying to us here, one of the things that I would look forward to with this, and I hope they do it, is, because it's always, with the Avatar stuff, it's always very much like superhero stuff. They solve stuff by punching it.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited to see them try and find a way that does not involve the usual big smashy fighty fights.
Yeah, and if it's politics, how do you use superpowers against politics?
Yeah, exactly. And also, they do come up with a plan kind of at the end of the of the book, I guess, because it's not really an issue.
Yeah.
And not to spoil it, but the idea they come up with is, I mean, I love it. It's fixing kind of one of the weaker plot points of Legend of Korra. And I think long-term Avatar fans are going to be very happy with what they want to do. Because that's, I'll just say, they need to find a candidate who is maybe kind of beloved by the Earth Kingdom and so stands a better chance of winning this election. And I think in the Earth Kingdom, there's only one figure with that kind of legendary status.
Yeah.
It's tough, Rob, but don't tell the audience.
I was trying not to say anything.
It's fine. We can just forget to edit that part out.
I'll be honest, Toph is still my favourite character.
Because she's objectively the best one.
I know she is.
Anyway, yeah, that's Legend of Korra. As with the previous ones, I really like the art does make it just look like sort of still images from the TV. I mean, I guess not just still images from the TV shows, like got the sort of motion between comic book panels. Like everyone still looks on character and the writing like gets all their voices right as well. So yeah, it's a good time.
Excellent. So me then.
Yeah, I guess it's you next in this weird free form lack of structure thing we're doing now.
Well,
we'll call this our jazz period.
Yeah, jazz hands. I've got Captain America, Winter in America. It's written by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and it's got pencils by Lionel Francis Yu, inks by Jerry Anguillen and Lionel Francis Yu, colours by Sonny Gore, letters by VCs Joe Caramagna and Corey Petit, and the covers by Alex Ross. And the cover's actually a very World War II cover with Captain America on the cover and various battleships and planes and explosions. And I have to say, I'm surprised by this. After what happened with Secret Empire, right? After Civil War II and Secret Empire, when Hydra took over America and everything like that, I was kind of disappointed with just how Marvel were approaching the whole idea of crossovers, and especially I was disappointed with how Marvel were treating Captain America. But I kind of like this because it's a lot more introspective with regards to Captain America as a character than a lot of other stuff. And it also has a different perspective of, or a slightly different perspective of the Hydra takeover of America. I mean, this whole bit, there are powers that are rising, and something is rising to replace the void left by Hydra, but nobody seems to know exactly what it is. They just know that something will replace it, and so everyone's trying to get ready for it. But in the midst of all this, you have these clones of a character called Nuke, who is a kind of a super soldier, I suppose he is, with the American flag painted on his face, and they've suddenly become terrorists, and they're cybernetic organisms who are basically quoting the same thing. Remember our boys dying in the deserts, hate us for our strength, things like that. And then you have a couple of other characters, one of them a blonde-haired woman, another a black-haired woman called Selene, or Selene. And she seems...
Selene, I think.
Selene?
The one is like a weird energy vampire one.
Yeah, I was going to say she seems to be some kind of energy vampire. Sucks the life force out of men and women and things like that. The blonde-haired woman... See, this is where it gets a bit weird because it kind of is reflective of the political situation in America. And this is why I think it's got a slightly different take on the whole Hydra takeover of America, when Steve goes and he talks to people in the heartland of America, where all the working class people are. You know, the people there are saying that Hydra fixed the schools, took out the drug pushers, got everybody free healthcare, brought back the jobs. Hydra gave them stability and gave them a future.
Hold on, are you saying President Obama was Hydra all along?
I think it's maybe the other one who was Hydra all along, Mick. You know, the melty cheeseburger man.
Yeah. And the thing is, it may be propaganda, because Steve's not from around there, and maybe it's propaganda that they're programmed or blackmailed or bribed into saying. But if enough people believe it, it becomes the truth, you know? And so in amongst all this, you have Selene and this blonde-haired woman who seems to be Russian. And the interesting thing is that from their perspective, they're coming to America as liberators, because in the heartland of America, they see and they hear what the people in the heartland of America are saying. And to them, it's a communist message. And so what they want to do is become the liberators of America by bringing communism to America using superpowers.
Sounds weird, but yeah, I think I feel like Captain America should be like quite political.
Yeah. And in amongst all this, you have the blonde-haired woman's husband, who was a general, but is now the Red Skull, kind of in the body of this general, or the Red Skull's soul in the body of this general.
Oh, is this like Alexander...
Lukin, yeah.
Lukin, yeah.
And you have Rasputin, who is this blonde-haired woman, Alexa, her name is.
Oh, so Selene's just bringing her around so that she can ask her advice then. Yeah. Maybe get her to play her favourite playlists.
Alexa, summon my husband back from the dead. So, yeah, she's apparently a student of Rasputin who is making an appearance in this. And, yeah, they want to bring a new dawn, a new day to America. I'll be honest, I found this very, very interesting reading. I was surprised because, as I said, it's a lot more introspective. After a terrorist attack, for example, Steve makes some comments about being brave to a young boy whose dad's been shot. But it says it's a good speech. But still, there are the losses. What speech is there for the mother who's lost her two daughters? What words can explain how our government allowed this? How the killers bear the flag of that government, the same flag as me? And that's why I like it.
That sounds pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. It's surprising. And I love the fact that Ta-Nehisi Coates took the character in this direction where he's actually questioning the meaning of the flag, because he made an oath to the flag, and that's what he says. I made an oath to the flag. But when the flag starts representing something completely different, how strong is that oath? I mean, ultimately, the story is all about symbols. Because it's easier to kill the man, Steve Rogers, but how do you kill the idea of Captain America?
And that's why he takes up his new code name, Wingdings.
On the other hand, it was easy to kill off the idea of US Agent.
I feel like you just got to just give him a little push and kick some dirt over him.
Yeah. Anyway, Mick.
Yes. So I've been reading the collection of Jed McKay and Daniello Beru's Man Without Fear, The Death of Daredevil. Now, Daredevil's had a bit of a tough time of late. Charles Soule killed the character off in his swan song storyline. Matt Murdock accidentally killed a common criminal in Chip Zdarsky's run, apparently. Netflix cancelled him.
That's not in there, is it?
Sorry?
That's not in the comic, is it?
No, it's not in the comic. I'm just saying that Daredevil himself has been through a lot.
Oh, right, okay.
Right.
He's had a bit of a day.
It's he's probably not at his best. So, this five-issue run, The Man Without Fear, picks up after, let's face it, Matt's had a bit of a going over. He's not in a good way. He's ended up being hit by a truck, and he's laid in hospital, and it's touch and go. It really is. Because the problem is, the truck itself, he could probably have survived. But what's happened is that layer upon layer upon layer of injury and remodeling and broken bones and healing and stuff like that have impacted Matt's body. And it's taken a toll, and there's blood pooling in places where blood's not supposed to pool internally. And it, the doctors are not giving him much of a chance.
Wait, so are you trying to say he's full of kill puddles?
He's full of kill puddles, yes.
I think the other thing as well, because Matt Murdock is basically Batman without the budget, isn't he?
Yeah.
So it is kind of cool, though, because I feel like comics almost never sort of address the fact that, hey, if you break your arm, like, even after it heals, there's still, like, a level of scar tissue.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Matt Murdock's body at this point is probably just all scar tissue.
Yeah, he is. He is more scar tissue than Deadpool singing a Red Hot Chili Peppers song.
But, yeah, so what we actually do is we go on a trip inside Matt Murdock's mind. He's basically in a coma, trying to heal his incredibly damaged body. And the man without fear actually has to face his inner fears, which is both this collection's strength and its weakness.
Okay.
In much the same way that, paradoxically, a man dressed as a devil links all his guidance back to his Catholic faith. So, you get a lot of cameos. Foggy goes to visit him in hospital, as he would, because his best mate's laying there, and starts talking to him. Kingpin visits him in hospital and threatens to do horrible things to his city. At the edge of the comic, there's an element of, we're not sure which of these visitations is real and which isn't.
Hmm.
But there's lots of revisiting some of Daredevil's greatest mistakes. You know, innocent people that have fallen by the wayside, Karen Page, those kind of people.
That yellow costume.
That yellow costume, indeed. And the history of Daredevil is covered, so we get to see him in a bit of an Iron Fist get-up. We get to see him in a bit of an original sort of bandana polo neck get-up, a bit season one of Daredevil, if you like. And there's flashbacks to a period where he fought alongside, like, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage and Iron Fist and stuff, that whole Defenders piece. Reference to adventures against the Fool Killer. But all the time it's about his guilt and his fear of losing someone, his fear of letting someone down, his fear of not being able to protect his little bit of New York City.
Mm.
And it's great for the first couple of issues. By the time you get to issue 4, you're starting to think, yeah, I get the point now. Thanks. Yeah, I understand. Face your fear. Yeah. The pain means nothing. Yeah. I get that. Yeah, Matt's lost people. He's made mistakes. Yeah, we get that. Get on with it. So it's one of those things where the actual premise is really good. The artwork is stunning. The inner demon is depicted really well by a succession of artists. It starts off with Bayruth. But you've got Stefano Landini, Aben Coelho, and Paolo Villanelli all bringing their own interpretation of Murdoch's inner demons to the fore.
Mm.
But it's one of those instances where you can get too much of a good thing. It's enjoyable, but it's like, you know, when you watch when you watch an 8-season run of a series and you think to yourself, they could have done that by the end of season 7. It's that kind of a thing. It ran for 5 issues in single issue format. It could probably have done with being 2-3 tops.
I mean, if it did, if did 3 issues, then they could have used the other 2 issues for something else, or maybe start showing him on his road back, if there is a road back.
I think what might have been, well, no, you get to see him on the road back. You get to see him overcoming the physical limitations. So, like, the doctors are saying, you know, you'll probably get 20, 30% mobility back. And he has to get up on the treadmill and prove them wrong and all the rest of it. And he's working alongside Luke and Jessica, trying to get that strength and power back.
It's got to be a bit of an awkward conversation, isn't it, sir? So, Doc, theoretically, 20 to 30% mobility. If, and again, purely hypothetically, if I were to backflip off a skyscraper, would that be enough?
With nunchucks. But, and this is the point, and you get that whole, you know, there's a lot of metaphor, the battle against the physical injury, the battle against his own demons, the man without fear, is he without fear or is he just ignoring it? Those kind of things. But it's very much a rinse and repeat kind of thing, and it's...
Yeah, sounds like a classic bit of Marvel. We need to stretch this series out so we can fit it into a trade.
Yeah, and it does feel like that. I would have preferred this, I think, to be a trade that had two storylines in it. A little bit like the Daughters of the Dragon one that I did a few weeks ago had a couple of storylines in it. They were loosely linked.
Yeah. Alternatively, it might have been interesting to see, because anytime you have a situation like that, it's not just the person who is suffering from the physical disabilities that suffers. It's the people around them as well.
Yeah, and you do get some of that, but it centres around Matt. It might have been nice to have a couple of issues that sort of showed Luke and Jessica, because we know that they're a thing now.
Yeah.
Maybe we could have had a couple of issues where we see how it impacts them, and do they start second-guessing stuff they do when they're dealing with...
Yeah, I know. Foggy knows he's Daredevil. So it would have been nice to have an issue, or part of an issue, dedicated to just Foggy. How is he coping?
Yeah, and you do get, you know, there's a little bit of a monologue where Foggy's looking out the window while he's visiting Matt, and he's sort of talking about, you know, it's great having Daredevil protecting the street, but the thing that I can never forget is that, you know, we're talking about my best friend.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. I hate Daredevil because he put you where you are now. That kind of sentiment. But they're little vignettes. And you're right. Maybe if you were going to stretch this out to go to trade, maybe a Foggy story is an issue. Or even, you know, a recap issue that just goes through. Because, you know, this one actually works quite nicely as a fairly standalone trade. It's a nice little psychological exploration of what it's like to be inside Matt Murdock's head. There's a little bit covering, you know, the fact that in a way he didn't kind of choose to be Daredevil, being Daredevil chose him, that kind of stuff. And it's great. It could just do with... It's a nice standalone story. So I've not read a great deal of Daredevil over time. My familiarity with the character comes mainly from catching up on a few issues prior to the Marvel Netflix series. So it's a standalone. As long as you know that Karen Page is dead, that's basically it. And that he fights Kingpin and Foolkiller and Bullseye a bit, that's fine. And that he's one of the Defenders. You don't need to know a great deal beyond that. It stands alone quite nicely. But maybe an issue in this run that went over how he lost Karen, how he lost other people, might have just given you a little bit more context and might have prevented some of the repetition. So as I desperately try to retain our rating system, I'd say it's kind of worthwhile. It's in the charity shop pile.
I mean, I think the rating system itself might be heading towards the bin, but...
I know.
Anyway, we shall move on to my next one. And I have been reading Haruka Shiomiya's Kino's Journey, The Beautiful World, Volume 2. So this has got another couple of short stories about the mysterious woman known as Kino travelling up, well, some sort of post-apocalyptic wasteland on her motorbike. Yes, Swansea. On her talking motorbike Hermes, as they just go from city to city. Well, or I guess technically they're called countries. This has got another two stories in it. The Land of Majority Rule and The Land of Peace. And I've got to admit, something I kind of forgot after having finished the first volume, that is that It's not just sort of lovely, contemplative travel adventures. It's quite a dark series.
Yes.
Because in the land of majority rule, Kino and Hermes, they arrive at another city, country. I'm going to keep calling them cities, but arrive at another country. And actually, I think something that's probably my main complaint for this volume is it starts with them arriving at a seemingly abandoned country and spending a while sort of looking around for anyone about. And that's basically the same way as the second story in the last volume started. It just feels a little bit repetitive. One second, I'm just going to take a sip of water. So eventually, Kino does come across someone. It is the country's ruler and only inhabitant. So she kind of sits down with him and learns about that country's weird and kind of horrifying history. Because, you see, up until a few years ago, the country was ruled over by a fairly cruel and sadistic monarch who would execute anyone who disagreed with him. Also specifically executes them by like just dragging them up on a conveyor belt type device and then dropping them back down onto the street. And so he would do that to not only subjects who displeased them, but to their entire families as well. So eventually there was an uprising and the inhabitants of the country disposed of the king and executed him in the way he had taught them how, and decided that they were going to rule the country by majority rule. It's kind of any decisions were made just based on what the majority of the populace agreed on. Unfortunately, one of the main things that everyone could agree on was that any decisions that go against the majority are in fact treacherous to the country, and so whoever says them and all their loved ones should be executed. And you can see how eventually this leads to there being one person in the country left.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's kind of just this really dark look at sort of, I guess, the perils of, first of all, trying to go off just what the majority wants, and second of all, being ruled by people whose only experience of a ruling class is a horribly abusive one, and sort of the problems that leads to. So after that cheery vacation, Kino then travels onwards to the Land of Peace, a lovely country called Velaved, where Veldaval.
See, I detect some sarcasm in your tone.
No, it's lovely. Everyone's, very happy and prosperous. They're kind and welcoming to any guests who visit.
It's a utopia, yeah?
It is. I mean, there is the slight awkward problem of there being mountains of dead bodies outside the utopia.
Yes.
But it's okay. Turns out those dead bodies, they aren't from the people in the country.
Are they from the people who tried to take shelter in the country?
No. See, what happened is that Veldaval is at war with its neighbour, I think it's Velmusia or something it's called.
Okay.
And it turns out they've been at war for hundreds of years. But the problem with across all these hundreds of years, all the battles have inevitably ended up the same way, is that while one side might kind of defeat the other in battle, the war will like give them such heavy casualties that they won't have the strength to kind of actually go to the other country and take over. So it's essentially been a stalemate for centuries with just hundreds of casualties, until they came up with a fun novel solution. Because see, outside of both countries live the Tar-Tar-Tar tribe, a kind of primitive village of people just trying to get by.
I can see where this is going, and I don't like it.
Yeah. So instead, the war between the two countries is that they both send forces to opposite sides of the village and see who can kill the most people. And whoever gets the highest body count of tribesmen wins the war. It's a sad time.
Yeah.
Not only is it a sad time, but it's a sad time that ends with Kino just basically going, I have no idea what I can do about this situation. Because, like, even if she convinced them to stop slaughtering this tribe, they'd just go back to killing each other. So, kind of, ultimately, all she can do is just leave. This is a sad series, Rob, actually.
Yeah, I know. But it's Kino's journey, and at the end of the day, you know, the world is a beautiful place filled with horrible people.
Yeah, basically. Anyway, this series is still really good.
Yeah, like, say what you want about this, about each country or city that Kino visits, you know. The overall series is just, it is up there.
It's fantastic, and I think this one has the advantage of, because they're quite heavy stories, this volume feels a bit more meaty than the last one.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's Kino's journey. It's kind of horrifying, but in a good way.
Yes. Okay, very quickly, I'm going to get this out of the way, because Andrew knows this already.
I do.
Right. And so, this is by Tim Seeley, with pencils by Carlos Villa, inks by Juan Velasco, with Carlos Villa, flashback artist Gerardo Sandoval, colour artist is Carlos Lopez, letters by VC's Corey Petit, and cover art by Yasmin Putri. And this is Shatterstar, Reality Star. And the reason why I'm not chuckling at the name Shatterstar is because this is a little bit like Kino's journey. It's wonderful and tragic at exactly the same time.
Yeah. You've fallen into the trap, Rob. You're in the Shatterstar Club now.
At least it's not the new Bond movie, which I will chuckle at later. This is collecting Shatterstar issues 1-5. And what's his name? Ben something. Shatterstar's real name, isn't it?
Well, technically his real name is Gavidra 7.
Yeah, Gavidra 7, but they call him Ben something or other. I can't remember.
He's Ben Gavidra.
Ben Gavidra, that's it. And he is the landlord now of a small apartment complex filled with a variety of people.
I mean, the most important of whom is Pogue Smasher. An alternate universe version of the, like, country-hating Flag Smasher, who is a pug.
Yep. Pug Smasher is great, but also in there is Goldon and Crimzor, who are former Rajas of the Scorpus Citadel. There's Kate Cook from Earth 1218, where there are no superpowers or gods or anything like that.
Yeah, I love that it's like, it's a talking animal, two He-Man-type dudes, a cyborg lady.
Yep.
And then just Kate, who's like an accountant.
The cyborg lady, is that the mutant commando?
Yeah, it's like the end woman.
Yeah, she's like a female version of Bishop, isn't she?
Yeah, basically. She's pretty rad as well.
Yeah. And then you've got probably one of the best residents from Earth 90214.
It was Earth 90210.
But from Earth 90214 is Old Man Night Thrasher. Also known as Dwayne Taylor. And so, yeah, in amongst all this, you have a bunch of people who come and kidnap all his tenants and kill Old Man Night Thrasher. And the people who come and kidnap all his tenants are the Death Sponsors, who have found a new master after Mojo was made redundant.
Yeah, he got kicked out of Mojo World, I think. Yeah.
And so basically, Shatterstar has to pick up his weapons again and go and rescue his tenants because he is their landlord. But along the way, he finds out that this whole thing is actually a ploy by the Grandmaster, who is bored because of his immortality, and he wants to bring Shatterstar back to the arena where he ruled. And so in this, you have I feel sorry for Kate and I feel sorry for Dwayne. I don't feel sorry for, what's his face? I can't remember his name. The one who tries selling Pug Smasher off for food.
Oh, yeah. I just know him as that jerk face.
Yeah, well, he does end up with his head on a trident wielded by Pug Smasher. He is. He is such a good boy. Ben and is it his boyfriend, Rick?
Oh, yeah, Richter.
Yeah, Julio Esteban Richter. He has seismic powers.
Hence the name.
Yes. And so yeah, you have this really interesting look at Shatterstar's life when he was a gladiator in the arena and everything around that, and how it differs so much from who he is now. And it really is an interesting look at a character. It's an interesting investigation of a character and how much they've changed over the course of their comic book career, so to speak. The weird thing is, there are a lot of parallels between these five issues of Shatterstar and that Captain America Winter in America. They're very introspective when it comes to the main character. And they're looking at things from a completely different perspective to how they used to look at them. I love how Shatterstar ends up resolving the situation, but it comes at a cost, you know? And I love his rationale for getting involved in this situation in the first place, because at the end of the day, these are just his tenants. He is their landlord.
Yeah, but they're still his responsibility.
Yeah. And this is why I say there are some strange parallels between this collected trade paperback and Captain America Winter in America. It's interesting because I do think they make a good back-to-back sort of thing.
Yeah, and I guess that works because both characters do kind of have that sort of man-out-of-time thing.
Yeah.
Like, Cat's from the 1940s. Shatterstar's basically like a protagonist from a whole different genre of story.
Yeah. He's come from, he's basically from like a sci-fi Conan novel, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this series does a really good job of playing up the idea, like the meta idea that he's come from a world where he is like the most famous man there to just being like some D-list X-Man who no one's heard of.
Yeah. And I think that they do parallel nicely with each other. I highly recommend Shatterstar and Captain America, Winter in America. While both of them didn't make me grin in the way of of certain other comics, or Charles Barkley and Godzilla having a basketball match, they are definitely comic book wins.
Yeah, it's an unusual side story. It made me grimace. It's a comic book win.
Yeah, don't think we'll be sticking with that one.
The show's over now.
Yes. he's right, it is the end of the show. So if you want to catch up with any of our previous episodes, you'll find them all on our website or on Apple Podcasts or Audioboom or wherever you get your podcasts from. You'll also find on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, all of our other shows on our network and reviews of various other things, including video games. I've got a couple up for like Zanky Zero and Close to the Sun and that. And you'll also find our Patreon and our shop as well. If you're listening through any podcast service, then leave us a rating, leave us a review. It does help us with exposure and the feedback helps us improve as well. That's it for this week. Until next time, I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.
Bah, 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 bah. That's the Godzilla theme tune.